we have a couple members coming in late, and we have two big hearings today, one on film production development and one on a property tax referral. And we have a lot of mayors here today, and I hope you guys can just cool your feet for a little bit while we do this film credit hearing. And I think it would be interesting for you guys because a lot of this is happening in your communities. And so I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1578. Chris, if you could kind of run us through the bill and put this in perspective.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1578 modifies the film and video tax credit. It increases the annual program tax credit cap from $10 million to $14 million. And it adjusts how the funds are used. There's a distribution in statute that gets modified in terms of dedicating funds to certain resources. And it also increases the limit for reimbursement to local filmmakers and local media production companies from $1 million to $5.5 million. It would apply to fiscal years beginning on or after July 1, 2016. You also have a dash, that's the drafted bill. You also have a dash one in OLIS. And I believe Senator Thompson maybe is going to describe what that does, but it adjusts that allocation of funds.
All right. And do you have a revenue impact?
Well, historically, these tax credits, they're sold by auction, and so the impact will be close to the $4 million per year. I don't have an actual formal statement yet.
Okay.
I'm still working on that, but it'll be close to the $4 million per year.
So for the 17-19 biennium, we're looking at $8 million.
That's one of the things I need to get into the details about. The if this were to become law this fall, they could sell, the film and video office could sell another $4 million in tax credits. So there would be a timing issue there. So it could be either 4 or 8, depending on how that lands in the current biennium to next biennium.
All right. And while I have you here, can you clarify the 92.5% of monies for those of us who are asking, and the 7.5% and the reason those formulas are broken down like they are?
The 92% is dedicated to reimbursements, marketing, and refunds. And that gets, under current law, it's a 95% that gets down to 92.5%. And then the 5% under current law is dedicated to local filmmakers and local production service companies, and that gets increased. So there's a shift to local.
Okay. Can you give us the policy reasoning behind that shift?
To dedicate more funds to local projects to help increase the growth of the industry within Oregon and Oregon employment and the local industry, rather than having production companies come from out of state to come here to make the videos and then leave potentially.
Okay.
It's about local growth.
Full-time local jobs versus transitory jobs.
Right. Correct.
I see that there's an addition about the video games in here as well.
Yes, that's another aspect that they'd like to expand the funds for. That there's a lot of potential growth with video gaming programming in the state.
Didn't we do something about this last session?
You did hear a bill last session. It did not pass.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have a couple of state senators here today. They want to lead off the witnesses here, Senators Johnson and Thompson.
Sounds like a comedian act.
It does, doesn't it?
I think it is.
You first?
Cool. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I am very proud to be a representative of the district that sponsored From Oregon with Love, Kindergarten Cop, Goonies, Date with an Angel, The Vernonia Incident, Dune, Free Willy, this was not one of ours, a Disney IMAX, Volcano Movies. I served as Benji's personal pilot on Benji the Hunted. a million years ago, when I had a legitimate living, I was a commercial helicopter pilot, and our company did an enormous amount of work for the film and video industry. We were the aerial platform on a seminal movie called From Oregon with Love that I think I can say without too much contradiction was one of the things that helped cement our relationship with Japan. People saw Oregon, our beautiful scenery, our wonderful people, through that series that was a remarkable hit in Japan. Over the years, we flew on a number of movies. The one that I will particularly call to your attention for the impact that drawing film and video production to our state is an exemplar of is Goonies. Goonies was filmed in Astoria 25 years ago on the anniversary of Goonies. I thought that I was going to host an event with the mayor, and I thought this is a piece of cake. Everybody knows who I am in Astoria. I can get a hotel room easily. Every single hotel room within a 50-mile radius of Astoria was taken. I slept on the mayor's couch that night. As I jokingly said, cash registers rang like church bells that weekend. The phenomena continues 25 years afterwards. We've just celebrated the 30th anniversary of Goonies, and the same phenomena occurred. These productions, when they come to Oregon, have such a magnificent ripple effect, whether it's helicopter pilots, makeup people, food carts, the list just goes on and on of the residual effect, plus an opportunity to introduce our magnificent state to the world. I think that this is a misunderstood industry. I recall vividly Representative Schauffler deriding having film and video here in Oregon until he went out to one of the sound stages where guys with tool belts were building the sets for, I forget which, Leverage, one of the movies, and understood that working Oregonians are the principal beneficiaries of having these productions here. So my fondest wish, other than you pass this bill with my good colleague's amendments, is to have the Senate convened by a Vessen, and I commend this bill for your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Hass and committee. Everybody looks pretty much awake this morning. That's good. Thanks for having me here today. I'm here to support the film industry and got asked to submit the Dash One Amendment, which would allow, and we'll have experts come up later. Please save your questions for that. If you want to know about the movies that are made in Portland, please save those questions for my wife. That's the other reason I'm here, because she told me to support this amendment because she loves watching the shows on that are made in Portland. She's hooked on those things. So anyway, I believe what this would do, it allows the film industry folks that are in the Portland area to go outside of the I don't know the exact lines, but it allows them to go out into the more rural parts of Oregon, and so that would take more advantage of our natural resources and show the beauty of our state, and allows them to go outside, more outside the metro area, and film in those areas and still get the tax credits that they're getting now. So with that, I think I'd like to introduce Tim Williams and Gary Oxley. Is that okay?
No.
Or that's your job.
We'll get to that. Yeah,
okay.
That is my job.
All right. Thanks.
No, hold on. Do we have any questions for our two senators? I'll throw one out there just for everyone to kind of keep in the back of their brain. If it's $8 million in this next biennium or $4 million a year, are there any in our tax credit portfolio now, tax credits that we could remove to make up these funds? The hope of not breaking the budget. Can you help us with that one?
Mr. Chair, I'll take a shot at that. Not having the list in front of me, I wasn't prepared for the question. But I understand and I appreciate your leadership in saying instead of just piling on tax credits, we ought to have the discipline to see what tax credits have served their useful life and have achieved the goal for which they were instituted. I would be more than willing to engage in that exercise. I think one of the tests ought to be the ROI on the tax credits. And from my very cursory review, given that I don't sit on any of the committees, I would submit that there undoubtedly are. And I think that a lot of different activities that we want to put the state's imprimatur could benefit from that tax credit opportunity. We ought to rotate the herd occasionally, and I would be more than happy to see on further review if I could come to the committee and make a suggestion. I think this one is unique in its residual effect, a la Goonies 25 years later, or any of you that are parents and have had the opportunity to watch Benji run through the woods for years and years and years. This is the gift that keeps keeps on giving. And I think we should discipline ourselves to engage in that exercise. And I'll just bet you we can find one to retire and substitute with the augmented credit for film and video.
Thank you, because that really is the much harder question on all of these tax credits.
Well, I would make the promise to you that I'd be happy to review the list and bring you my suggestions, but I am one out of 90.
We will bring you the list. It's a book about this thing.
Yeah.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate, Senator, your answer. You're a Ways and Means member. You have to make the same type of decisions in the budget committees. Mm-hmm. And for the last several years, when I was a member of Ways and Means, people would come with the ask, and when we're cutting budgets and stuff, and I'd always say, do you have any suggestions what we ought to cut so that we can fund your program? And invariably, they would say, we know that you have tough decisions. But no, we don't have an answer. And so I appreciate your willingness to engage in making the tough decisions that need to be made in order to fund, you know, great programs.
Thank you.
Okay, thank
great
you.
Great question. I'll do the same.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll go to Tim Williams and his team.
We're not.
Looks like this is the team.
This is the team.
Oh, I have a couple others, but they can come up. You
well,
want to come up there with me?
Okay, let's bring up Neil Kopp and Sean Nipper.
Yep.
Kind
Sean
of as Neil. A panel.
I'll start off, if that's okay, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman. Chairman Haas, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak to you this morning. My name is Tim Williams. I'm the executive director of Oregon Film, which is the state film and media office. I'll try to keep this brief, as I know you have lots of people to speak, not only to this bill, to other bills, but I'd like to give some background data to the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF. Since the introduction of OPIF in 2005, Oregon Film has tracked the economic activity directly attributed to the incentive program, rising from just below $10 million per year to almost $170 million per year, while the number of tracked jobs has climbed from just 500 in 2005 to more than 3,000 this past fiscal year. More than 100 individual projects and countless local companies and producers have been directly assisted in Oregon over the last decade. And because of the growing permanent talent base here in Oregon, 20 of the 23 projects and companies aided by the state's incentives program in the last fiscal year were either directly produced by Oregon companies or individual Oregon producers, utilizing a large crew and a large local vendors. As a point of reference, in season 3 of The Librarians, in just the third quarter of 2015, they engaged and paid more than 300 local vendors for work done on that series in only a 3-month period. Even the small-budget feature film Black Road, produced and shot in Ashland and Brookings, engaged more than 70 local vendors, and this does not include the various vendors engaged on a small cash basis during on a daily basis. The story that is unfolding is a balanced system that imports work into the state as much as creates work from established companies already here in the state. The incentive programs are instrumental in making media work more competitive here in Oregon and a national landscape that now currently has more than 30 states offering film and media incentive programs. However, because our program is capped on an annual basis, we continue to have many missed opportunities. Currently, in order to keep even the multi-year TV series that we've worked very hard to attract, we will come up short in the coming fiscal year in order to retain these productions, and we are borrowing from the future. This process cannot continue, and we will fail to meet the needs of those of our long-standing TV series, surely leading to at least one of those moving to a new production base like Vancouver, BC, or Atlanta, Georgia, who offer more lucrative tax incentive programs. As was pointed out, Senate Bill 1578 seeks to raise the annual cap of OPIF from $10 million a year to $14 million per year. In addition, it would increase the amount allocated for indigenous production, or IOPIF, from 5% to 7.5%, effectively doubling the funds available to smaller, locally based projects. It also allows for locally produced, larger budgeted interactive and post-production projects to qualify for the larger OPIF program, keeping up with the continued and steady growth of those industries here in this state. Lastly, I'd like to speak briefly about the Rural Initiative Amendment that was introduced by Senator Thompson here this morning. This new proposed program, or ROPIF,
is a much-needed addition to our program, which would not only financially encourage existing Portland-based productions like Portlandia, Grimm, and The Librarians to shoot at least a few of their days of their schedule outside the Portland metro zone. It also has a second part to the proposed amendment, which would further incentivize productions basing themselves completely outside of Portland for the majority of their shoot. As Senator Johnson mentioned, most of our iconic movies have been shot outside of Portland, including The General in Cottage Grove, Paint Your Wagon in Baker City, The Goonies in Astoria, Animal House in Eugene, Stand By Me in Brownsville, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest here in Salem, and much more recently, Wild in Bend, Crater Lake, and Ashland. The incentives question is what starts the conversation with all producers and companies who call from both outside the state and from here within Oregon. In those cases where we are able to offer something in the way of incentives, we generally are able to close the deal and make sure amazing work is produced by amazing talent already living here in the state year after year. So through OPIF, we have seen a consistent growth in the creation of well-paying jobs with benefits and the engagement of countless local vendors, a diversity of creative economic projects being produced here in the state, and with the introduction of this rural amendment, we will have a specific tool to encourage more creative work in all parts of the state. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Why don't we go to our other two guys and ask you some questions?
Cool. Okay. Sure. Go ahead. Yeah, good morning. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Neil Kopp. I'm a film producer based in Portland. I know that you are extremely busy today, so I'll be brief. But this topic is extremely important to a whole class of creative and technical professionals in the state. So this is my story, but I hope that it in ways can speak for all. I was born and raised in the Montevilla neighborhood in Portland and went to Vancouver Film School in British Columbia. I moved home for the summer to save money for my big move to Los Angeles to, you know, advance my career in film production. But really, at the root, my story is about how that move never happened. That first summer, I worked for Will Vinton Studios as a production assistant, and then was hired as a staff production coordinator at Food Chain Films, which is sort of an institution of commercial and music video film production. Over the course of 3 years there, I produced 30 commercials a year, just in and out the door. It was sort of in hindsight, it was a boot camp for my future as a film producer, really. So within a week of going freelance, I got a call from a New York-based director, Kelly Reichert, who wanted to shoot her feature film, Old Joy. Before I even finished the script, I just accepted the job because it was a movie and it was what I kind of had always wanted to do. We shot that film in Estacada, and it went on to premiere at the Sundance Film Festival in 2006 and sort of launched her in my career. To date, I've produced all five of her films, as well as three films for other directors, including Gus Van Sant's Paranoid Park and Jeremy Soni's Green Room. Seven of my eight films were produced top to bottom here in Oregon. And that's that one missing film is something I'd like to come back to. Now, quickly, these aren't just small local films. I want to be humble about this, but the truth is that they're mid-size independent films, average budget of $2.5 million. They require, you know, name celebrity actors to finance. Michelle Williams, Jesse Eisenberg, and Dakota Fanning and Patrick Stewart. You know, they've done well. They've gone to Cannes, Venice, Toronto, and they've all received theatrical distribution and are currently licensed by distributors in North America, as well as 40 countries have been translated into 20 languages. And, you know, they've really gotten out there. In this competitive state incentive market, like, the very first question we're asked by financiers and studios is, what kind of soft money are we talking about? It's every film now. It's really the first question. Now, none of the money I've raised, which has come from Oregon wealth or investors, it's all come from out of state. And not the total budgets, but the total in-state spend of these films of ours have been $8.5 million. That is pretty conservative. That, you know, accounts for tens of thousands of union work days, pension and health benefits, not to mention, you know, local hotels, catering and vehicles and catering, which everybody has sort of already talked about. But that one film that got away, Kelly Reichert's last film, Certain Women, is, I think, an important point to make. It starred Kristen Stewart, Michelle Williams, and Laura Dern. And it was financed by Sony. And we premiered it actually 2 weeks ago at Sundance. It
we wanted to shoot so badly in Oregon. Aside from Michelle Williams, who's been in three of our films, Oregon itself is really the other muse of our director, Kelly Reichardt. Our features have shot in, none have really been based in Portland. Astoria, St. John's, Estacada, and Medford have been sort of our home bases, sort of to speak to that rural thing. But this time around, there just wasn't the money, you know, really because of all the other great things shooting in Oregon. So sort of a double-edged sword. It's great for everybody, but the only way to, like, round that out is by an increase in the program. So that story aside, I am extremely fortunate to have a career here doing what I do. It is a special thing that I am privileged to have. Now, my wife, who I met in the food court at Clackamas Town Center in 1995 in high school, she is a costume designer and has done all six seasons of Portlandia, for which she's won two Emmys. We own a home, and we just had our first child 8 days ago. You know, there's been a lot of traffic through our living room to see the baby, friends from childhood, friends from high school who work normal jobs, and they just cannot understand how a girl from Clackamas has two Emmys on her bookshelf. And it's amazing to them, and most days we can't sort of believe it ourselves. But I guess that's sort of a new reality that I believe should be more common in Oregon. And it's within our grasp, and, you know, that's something that we're committed to keep the projects coming for and growing. So we ask for your support. Thank you.
Neil, that's a very heartening story. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
But it's very heartening, you know, that you didn't have to leave Oregon for Southern California. You know, that's really nice. John.
Yeah. Hi, good morning. Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee. So my name is Sean Mark Nipper, and I have a production company in Ashland, but I actually grew up in Ashland in Southern Oregon for 27 years looking at those mountains. I'd had enough of those hills, and I decided to move to the Bay Area. And 13 years spent there, I went to film school, started a family, and one Thanksgiving trip back to Ashland, which I was never going to return to ever again. My wife said, you know, it's really nice here. I'm like, yeah, I know, but wait a minute. Gosh, these mountains are really pretty. And I looked through a different lens at these gorgeous mountains and did some research, and I found out that Ashland and Southern Oregon was named the best place to live and work as a filmmaker for 3 years now. In 2014, it was number two. In 2015, Ashland was named number one. And this year, it's number five in a large list of bigger cities. So the choice was really easy at that moment to move back to Ashland and become a filmmaker. One of my first jobs getting back was working with David Sidden from Wildlife Images, releasing a bald eagle back into the wild that had been rehabilitated. I had a chance to finish the documentary that I've been working on, looking for the story that I needed for this film for 4 years, and I finally got that part of the story, and it's incredibly moving, and I got that when I moved back to Southern Oregon. The amount of impact that this area has is far greater, I think, than we can really verbally explain. Everywhere you go, everywhere you point a camera, there is beautiful imagery that is unmatchable. There's enormous amount of impact that people have when making a film here. This is just a small list. It's actually much larger of all the businesses that are impacted when larger films come into town. Black Road being one, they had a huge impact on the local businesses. But like I said, this is just a small list. So not only is the incentives and funds that help productions offset some of the costs, it also has an environmental impact with the community. And not only, you know, with the filmmakers, but their people and their families as well. So the amount of revenue that comes in, it's exponential. So I'm grateful that I get to do what I love. I get to be a filmmaker with my two boys, and it's a great honor. So hopefully you guys will see to help expand the incentives outside of Portland, make it grow in the rest of Oregon, and I get to keep doing what I'm doing. Thank you.
Terrific. Questions for our panel here. let me ask a
about the amendment on rural. I mean, that's, I think it's a nice thought. Is it practical? Will we have people making movies and say, all right, you know, to get that other, go out and shoot some cows in Eastern Oregon, maybe we can use those. I mean, is it practical, or will it just, is it a make work kind of thing, or what?
I can speak to the development of it, Chairman Haas, if that's okay. As some of you know, I was actually an independent producer for about 15 years before taking this job with the state. And one of the things that I found when going into a state and looking at incentive programs, there's certain things that move the needle and certain things that don't really apply to what you're doing on a budgeting sense. And one of the things we tried to do with this amendment was talk to the people on the ground who actually were doing the work either in Portland or even those like Neil that have shot well outside of Portland, and what would move the needle for them to make it more interesting to be outside. And that's why there's two tiers to this. So the first part is, how do we get the productions that are already in Portland, how do we get them to go outside? And there's a 30-mile zone that's that you have to be within in order to avoid overtime and accommodation costs on union contracts. So the first part of this would attest to that component, in that there would be a small stipend that would allow them to go outside and offset some of those additional costs for being 30 miles outside of the zone. So Grimm could go outside and shoot in Monmouth, for example, and spend two nights there, and would have 100 people coming in, staying in hotel rooms, eating dinner there, buying coffees, and that would be an immediate injection into that, and there would be a small offset for that. And according to the producers of Grimm and the librarians of Portlandia, the piece that we put in place for that would actually help them make that decision. In addition, the other films that have shot well outside Portland, like Brothers-in-Law in Klamath Falls, even Wild, that was based for a long time in Bend, Meek's Cutoff, which was out in Burns. The idea there was give them a sort of a larger piece of the OPIF fund for being outside of there, so that they have a one lump sum that incentivizes them to stay out there rather than come back to Portland. And again, I think it's a number that's not so huge that it depletes our system too fast, but it's enough to make it interesting and allow them to financially stay out there and employ local people and actually base themselves out there for a month or two rather than just two or three days. So I'm hopeful that what we have is the basis of something that works for the industry, but also works within the limited funds that we have, so that it balances that system in a good way.
Senator Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. as you know, I'm usually don't like indirect expenditures, but most of our tax credits do one good thing. This tax credit does several good things, and so it's an exception for me. This not only makes good jobs, a lot of them, all over the state, but it also brings tourism to the state. And This is a moneymaker for the state of Oregon. So it's one of the few tax credits that I really think should be a tax credit. And so I will be supporting these, both the amendment and the bill. But again, it's one of the very few tax credits that I really think should be a tax credit.
Further questions, Senator Boquist?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You had your hand up.
No, I was just being courteous as a vice chair to let you know that Senator Riley had a question.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate you guys coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick was to be here and testify on this. She's not here yet. So there's no one else signed up on this bill right now. So we're going to close this public hearing for now. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 201. Kyle is the economist on this bill, but I can say that this is a concept that we spent a great deal of time on in the 2015 session. This committee working on ways to clean up our property tax system, and most of you know that the reason it has to be a referral is because most of the language that we would seek to change is locked into the constitutional. Therefore, it needs a vote, and so we struck upon this way that if you offer homeowners a tax cut, you might get close to 50%, in addition to cutting taxes, you can clean up some of the Measure 50 language. So we just took one swing at this, and we know we don't have it perfect, and I appreciate some of the input we've received since this became public a few weeks ago, but it's still very much a work in progress, and so I hope you treat it like that, and we're sort of all in this together. So that's kind of the spirit we're looking at this. You want to give us a brief overview, Kyle?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So yes, SJR 201, it does propose an amendment to the Oregon Constitution, and it'd be submitted to the people for their approval or rejection coming up this fall. And the amendment repeals the measure that, or the components that are largely referred to as ballot measure 50 that passed in 1997. But it repeals the language, and then it inserts language that in a lot of cases, much of it is the same language that was in Measure 50. So there's a few changes to Measure 50, but some of the components more or less do stay in. So just as a brief reminder to the committee again, the two major constitutional components of the property tax system are Measure 5, which are the limits, the education limits, and the general government limits. Those remain unchanged. And then Measure 50 is the growth limits. So you have the real market value and the assessed value and the 3% growth limits. And the Measure 50 also changed the property tax system from a levy-based one into one based upon rates. So districts now have rates. And I say that the rate component does remain. So that language does come back in. So the change here is really about removing that real market value, assessed value, maximum assessed value. So taxing rates will be applied to real market value as opposed to assessed value and everything along those lines. The other major changes contained in SJR 201 are, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, the homestead exemption. The legislature is required in this amendment language to put in place a homestead exemption. The actual specific amounts and everything are not in the Constitution. That would be up to the legislature to put in statute. A secondary component is, and this is a may, it's not a shall, so the legislature may include provisions to, the committee discussed this a little bit in the last session, use more of a moving average approach to real market value. So that, there could be a statute change to look at maybe the last 3 years or something on those lines in placing a value on a property, and that would smooth things out a little bit, some of the ups and downs. Yeah. But again, that's a may, not a shall. But so those are the major components. I would also just mention, in addition to this, there would have to be a number of there would have to be some conforming language as well to make things work. So these changes, there's quite a bit of residue, I guess, that'd be left over and cleaning things up to make sure it all works out fine. And then one other thing I would mention is the specially assessed properties remain specially assessed with these changes too. So farmland, forest land would still be specially assessed. So those are the major components. And then I do have a document in OLIS under the meeting materials. It's similar to the one that the committee looked at or saw in the SJR 27 discussion, I believe, during the 2015 session. But it's titled Revenue Example. And so what I did here is I more or less superimposed the changes contained within SJR 201 onto the 2014-15 property tax year, which is the most recent year we have the complete data set for. And that way it gives you some sense of the different changes and where a homestead exemption could be placed and what the impact on revenue would be. Just a couple of things to note in making these estimates. These are not calculations, first of all. They are estimates. There's a lot of data we do not have to just go in and make these as calculations. So they are estimates. but I assume that the homestead exemption would be statewide. So if you put in a homestead exemption of, say, $25,000, that would apply to $25,000 of property across the state, whether it's Multnomah County, Malheur County, Jackson County, it would all be $25,000. Of course, the legislature could adjust that if they saw fit. And then there's no dynamic effects included here. So this is really just a static estimate. But as you can see up there on the screen, the column chart I have there, it starts off in the left column. You see it's fiscal year 2015, $5.7 billion. So that was the imposed amount of property taxes in fiscal year 2015. The next grouping over there is removing the Measure 50 components in SJR 201 and then having a zero homestead exemption. So this is just the revenue increase from shifting to a real market value-based imposing of taxes on real market value, and you're looking at about $6.8 billion. So that's your initial revenue lift. And then I went ahead and put in increments of different homestead exemptions that'd be statewide. So the next one over, $25,000 homestead exemption, revenue's now at $6.5 million. $50,000 homestead exemption, 6.2, and so on and so forth. And you can see the break even is at or about 100,000. Again, that's from a static standpoint, not any dynamic changes. And then the higher the homestead exemption goes up, you would actually be getting into negative overall revenue changes. The next chart down below the column one, the committee may remember this one, it just talks about the shift between the major property classes. So you can see by moving to real market value, you get an initial shift from more of the residential, multifamily, manufactured structures to more of the commercial, industrial. And that's largely a shift to commercial properties as they have a greater disparity between assessed value and real market value. And then as you increase the homestead exemption, of course, you shift more of those tax burden to the commercial industrial side as you're exempting residential property in part. And then something that's new from 2015 was I included some charts on the second page that showed the changes in different counties. And this isn't county districts. These are all the districts within county boundaries. But you can see, and a lot of this is based upon, there's a number of different things, but primarily your biggest effect is the difference between real market value and assessed value that exists drives a lot of the revenue lift. So you can see the different counties, when you switch to real market value, you do have a revenue lift in different areas, and this is based largely upon the different growth and everything that's been in place since Measure 50. So you can see Multnomah County initially gets the larger lift, and you see some of the other counties, it's a smaller lift. And I'd also just note, the data set that I have to work with that allows me to do some of these computations is missing six of the smaller rural counties. So that's why we only have 30 counties up there. They represent about half of 1% of overall imposed, so it's a pretty small amount. But each one of these charts just goes through the different level of the homestead exemption. So you can get a visual on, as you increase the homestead exemption, when you start to get to even the 50,000 or the 75,000 level, you start to dip in some counties where they're actually receiving less revenue than they are under the current system. And a lot of that is largely due to, one, the makeup of their property tax base, whether it's heavily residential or heavier, maybe commercial or industrial or utility. But it also has a lot to do with just the value of residential property. So if you have a homestead exemption of, say, 75,000, that could take out a lot more of the residential base in some of the counties where home value is less than in some of the more metro counties. But just to give some sense of the different regional effects. And that's all I have.
Thank you. You've done a lot of work on this, and I suspect you'll continue to do that. So let's take up a couple of panels here, beginning with Beaverton Mayor Denny Doyle, Councilor Brad Ivanke, and Wendy Johnson. And as they make their way up here, I want to make a couple more points on this measure. One of the biggest issues in our legislature this short session is housing and the cost of housing. And I think this measure, when you reduce people's property taxes, you're doing more for housing and affordability than any of those housing proposals I've seen bouncing around in this building. And also, just to assure the local government people here that as we've been discussing this, whatever this comes out to be, if there was a net loss in this, no one has contemplated, just that's okay. We've always assumed that if that in that occurrence, there will be some kind of mechanism that's relatively common in government in these sort of situations where there's a committee where some calculation will be made to make the local governments whole for whatever we do. So that's always just been an automatic. And thirdly, we have done an Oregon tax incidence model on similar property tax cut proposals here. And in every one of those, it shows positive benefits for the economy, mostly as a result of housing prices becoming reducing and becoming housing becoming more affordable. It affects construction, in-migration, business, and all of those things. So it's a very positive economic benefit when you lower the cost for homeowners of housing. So with that, thank you, Mayor.
Wendy. Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As you know, the League represents 242 cities, and property tax reform has been a priority of the League this year and for many years. And so we're really happy to be here today and talk about this bill. It's the first time we've had actual language to really engage in the details and the dialogue on how to fix the system that we have. Measure 5 is 25 years old, and so it really is past time to take a look at this again. We have two panels together put together today from the League. We'll have our president of the Board of Directors speak to you, Brad Nanke from Salem, counselor, and then Mayor Denny Doyle from Beaverton, our vice president of the board. And then I'll have a second panel from outside of Salem, Mayor George Endicott from Redmond, and Mayor John McCardle from Independence, and Don Hudson, the finance director from Tualatin. So we'll go into some specifics, but we once again want to thank you for engaging in this complex issue and all the difficulties in it. I'll run the PowerPoint for the mayors, and I'll have some comments that are more technical. They're going to hit some of the high points, but I'll comment some specifics after they finish.
Thank you, Wendy. Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for entertaining Senate Joint Resolution 201, property tax referral. We're very pleased, as Wendy said, that you're taking up what is our lead priority from the League of Oregon Cities. My name is Brad Nanke. I am in my 16th year as a Salem City Councilor and President of the League this year. And I'll talk a little bit about some of Salem's issues as we move forward. It is definitely a complicated issue. The chair has enumerated, you know, some of the difficulties contained therein. We're going to give you some background on why property taxes are so important to the League and our member cities, explain some of the problems with their present systems, and then talk a little bit about SDR 201 and some of the things it does and doesn't do. If we look at distribution of property taxes by taxing districts, you can see they affect all local governments and schools. Cities take a good chunk, not as much as the school systems. They are a big portion of local governments' budgets. In some cases, 60% or more. Schools, it's about a third of their budgets overall. The balance of that is made up by fees, miscellaneous franchise fees, other revenue that tends to remain flat over time, whereas our expenditures tend to rise. Most of our expenses are labor-based. And so the system is structurally not conducive to how a city works. So if we look at expenditures from a city overall, public safety is by far most cities' largest costs. Capital outlays, infrastructure is next. We, especially in the city of Salem, we used to have the Board of Shame that would come out every year talking about our infrastructure and how do we fund that. And that's balanced with, do we cut public safety? Large portion, and it's not just conservatives. Everyone knows the importance of public safety, but there are many cities throughout the state that are conservative overall from a council perspective, and for them to actually cut public safety, which is kind of the core of what they see city government doing, we know there's a structural problem with the system. And, you know, we see it's like, hey, we've cut almost 90 employees over the last 4 years. And at public hearings, when it's like, do we get rid of the library? Do we get rid of, you know, the last four parks maintenance personnel? Those are the decisions that councils are making all over the state. And it's very painful. We'll shoot over to the fact that most of the property taxes that we actually receive don't cover the total cost of that public safety. We also, inside of our general fund budgets, have to cover parks, libraries, roads. The gas taxes don't cover our current expenditures for road maintenance in Salem. A lot of that, actually, then we have to go out to general obligation bonds. Salem currently has one out right now. And it goes to the fact that our citizens understand when we go out to them and show them a true need that they will vote. And none of those general obligation bond funds fall inside of that cap that's currently imposed on property taxes as well. So citizens out there are willing to go to finance mechanisms that are not inside of property taxes as well.
Councilor, I'm going to need you to speed this up. There's 24 pages of your PowerPoint. We're not going to be able to do that.
Okay.
So I need you to just wrap up. We have a lot of people, a lot of other mayors and councilors here. Okay?
Can do.
Thanks.
A lot of this material the committee is aware of. Property taxes were capped at 10 per thousand for cities, local governments, and then 5 for schools. We can move on just briefly talk about compression. Essentially, when we go into compression, taxes are reduced until the limitations are reached. Which is why a lot of municipal governments are hesitant to actually put levies in, because they know they will be the first to be cut. And you actually have to ask for a lot more money than you'll actually end up getting back based on how much of your property is in compression. If we look at problems with Measure 5, again, and from a compression standpoint, you can see how much revenue was lost overall. In Salem, compression impacts from 2004 to 2015, so about 10 years, is $5.1 million. And you can look at losses overall from city schools and counties over time, which is a significant loss in capital potential for cities. So SGR 201, it does not adjust Measure 5 limits, so we need to either raise them or eliminate them, potentially with built-in caps. The limits, as Wendy had mentioned as well, were 25 years old. Low limits were put in place as voters thought they might be getting a sales tax as well. I know a lot of people were just tired of seeing their property tax bills go up 13 to 18% per year, and it was like, how do I stop this impact on my personal finances as a homeowner? And then levies, which are subject to compression, essentially have taken away a lot of voter choice, because a lot of jurisdictions won't even attempt them. So Salem's situation overall, we're estimating $60 million in property taxes for this fiscal year, compared to $65.7 million for our police and fire budget alone. We, as a local government, are over the $10 per thousand. We lost over $1 million in compression last year. And then just other structural pieces in there. You know, our permanent rate is $5.83. We do have the bond levies out there for streets and bridges, as well as a fire bond that was out. Well, you compare us to Eugene, we have essentially the same population. We sit there and garner back and forth, second and third largest in the state. They have a permanent rate of $7. It's a massive disparity throughout the system. From Salem, with our lack of a lot of property actually on the tax rolls as well, we, to run the same size city, are $30 million short of what Eugene has inside of their general fund for that. So a lot of disparities. Mayor Doyle will actually talk about some of those here as well.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Chair Haas and committee members. I'm Denny Doyle from Beaverton, as the mayor, and as well as the League of Cities vice president. The first chart, I'll try to pick up the pace. The first chart, I think the key factors are, look at the folks in the dark blue. They're paying taxes on 50% or less of their property's real market value. Those in red are paying 100% of the property's values. And that's due to the functionality of the current laws that I'm sure you're well aware of. This disparity goes out further east in the East Portland and Gresham. Despite being lower income, they are paying taxes on a higher percentage of their property values. That's something to keep in mind. The next slide, with the top of Measure 50, 1997, is just a recap of the fact that Measure 50 is 18 years old. The gap between AV and RMV is continuing to, is starting to grow again. That's something I think is going to be addressed, but it's important to point out. The next slide is under Oregon's property tax system. Similar valued homes can often have significantly different property tax bills. You've got the documentation here, but I think it's that should really sink in, the difference between House A and House B. That's about $3,400 difference in property tax per year for the same value of a house. So staff can get into the technicalities on that. The next is identifying, the next slide is showing that it's not just a Portland problem. This problem, as Brad has mentioned, is all over the state. They looked at the inequities of Multnomah, Deschutes, Jackson, and Sherman counties and found widespread inequities in all four. And I do believe the folks who framed these original bills have actually said they didn't realize what was going to be caused. So SJR 201, we support the components of this bill. The bill eliminates inequities caused by Measure 50 by eliminating AV computation. The bill goes back to the economic reality of RMV, which most homeowners do understand, gets rid of the 3% growth limit on AV, permits RMV average so that there's less volatility and more predictability for taxpayers and government. Caution, we need to have a transition period if we go forward with this, as well as it needs to address the significant permanent rate problems of Measure 50. Permanent rate in 242 cities in Oregon is shown on the next slide. Cities are frozen at rates all over the map because there was a set date and boom, it happened. And some are, as you can see, zero up to $10.60 per thousand. The next slide is SJR 2001. We would like to suggest amendments to be considered. Frozen permanent rates are arbitrary and don't have a tie to services needed today. The world has changed in 20 years. Permanent rates are 18 years old. Present rates create competition between taxing districts, new districts, special districts, and local options force compression, as you know. Penalize the districts that are imposing less than their permanent rate, of which there are 10 cities, and just happens to be Beaverton's one of those. I'll just touch on this briefly. Our tax rate authorities set at $4.62 per thousand. We are currently at about $4.17, $4.18 right now. We've held that line. Senator, I don't want to raise your taxes all at once, but I wouldn't want to let that 462 go by. So it's currently written, and it's just a suggestion that we need to really look at that to make sure that we don't penalize anybody in the process. Principles of tax reform: stability, predictability, fairness and equity, simplicity and clarity, adequacy and sustainability. You've read about our seven principles of property tax reform. I won't read them for you, but I think it really drives home where the locals are thinking, where we all live and work when we're not in Salem running around in a short session, and I admire the fact you're doing this. We touched about the principle of property tax reform, voter and local option, home rule is protected, competitive environment to retain and attract businesses. That's something I know we all have to think about, but it's really critical. We need to keep the economy going the way it is. And so I'm so glad you are looking at this rather complex subject, and I do appreciate all of it. And if we can be of help, just let us know. Thank you.
Thank you. You are of help, Mayor and Councilor. That those slides that show the two, you know, the four houses, I mean, those are really the poster child for this.
They're telling, yeah.
In fact, they're probably the Swiss Alps poster of property taxes. We have Swiss Alps lining up with our general fund to show the income tax volatility, and those houses should be made into a poster. So that's really what we're after. Yeah. You know, this is complicated, and there's 1,000 different parts in a tax reform bill like this, and it's hard if someone takes one of those parts and says, okay, this won't work, you know. So okay. That's kind of what we're up against. So thank you.
Thank you.
Sean Jillians, the Oregon Association of Realtors. Is Sean here? He is here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillian's representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Dutifully signed up last. Not sure how I got bumped up here, Mr. Chair.
Alphabetically.
Yes, I'm sure that was alphabetical. staff, if you'll please load the 42-page PowerPoint for me, we'll get into this. Just kidding. I actually just went back and looked at my notes from HJR 12 or any of the other ones that we've discussed in 2015 and the other versions to hit the high points. Mr. Chair, we do appreciate you bringing this proposal forward, as you and I have discussed for a couple years now. We do recognize that there are inequities in our property tax system, something that could be used to actually benefit homeowners. We're very supportive of and think you're heading in the right direction. You know, I'd also caution a little bit that it is complicated, and you all know that, and you're probably only going to get one shot at a referral to the voters on a constitutional amendment to sort of unwind measures that were passed with a popular support in our last sort of big uptick, other than our bubble this last time, where people saw greatly increasing property tax rates and were concerned about pricing themselves out of the homes that they were in. I think we're sort of in another one of those times. I'm not sure if all of you saw that Portland actually had the highest increase in real market value of any city in the U.S. the last 12 months. It was over an 11% increase. So anytime you're going to remove some of the caps and start tying yourself more directly to real market value, just bear that in mind, that sort of spike can occur. And as we become more and more popular of a place to live, I'm sure that you're seeing similar things in the Bend area and Southern Oregon as well. But Portland literally was the highest increase in the entire nation for a municipality. The most startling number in the research, and thank you, staff, for that research. It was excellent. It's a $6.8 billion increase in property tax revenue if you don't include a homestead exemption in there. I think anything moving forward probably is going to have that homestead exemption in some form locked in the Constitution. It's not that I don't trust you, Mr. Chair, or any of the members of this committee, but your successors, I'm not so sure about them. We're a little concerned about what they might do going down the line. So, I historically, from the Oregon Association of Realtors perspective, have said, we're very willing to look at this sort of model where you start maybe lifting some of the caps of the previous ballot measures. We're very intrigued by the prospect of a homestead exemption. We definitely think that if you're going to remove the caps, the homestead exemption needs to be in the Constitution as well. With that, Mr. Chair, I know you have a number of people signed up to testify. Happy to answer any questions. Happy to chat offline as well about this measure and potential referrals.
Thank you, Sean. I don't want to oversimplify this issue, but it would seem like if you're lowering the cost of housing here and more people will have better ratios when they go in for loans, that realtors would be selling more homes with the cost of housing falling as a result of the tax cut.
If the homestead exemption were put in at the right level, Mr. Chair, I think you're absolutely correct in that. I think it would have some impact on our coastal communities and Central Oregon, where you have a lot of non-owner occupied residences that are going to pay more. I don't think we know exactly what those impacts would be. But as you move forward with this, I think we're going to do a lot more sort of modeling and analysis. We actually have Eco Northwest working on a bunch of housing stuff for us right now, because as you all know, that's definitely the topic right now, other than little things like minimum wage that are taking up a lot of time in this building.
Senator Edwards?
There's so much to say.
And cap and trade for Senator Edwards as well. Cap and invest. Cap and invest.
Big transportation dollars for local governments in that bill.
Yeah.
Senator Boquist?
I just want to, 2 points and comments, really, Mr. Chair. First, to as Sean pointed out, we've been at this a while. I mean, this is not the first go-round. I apologize to anybody in the room who thinks this is the first go-round, but I distinctly remember, and the tape will show it, that the first time we talked about this exact concept was, I think, in February last year. And there were two lobbyists sitting in the back room, and I told one of them he needs to send an email out to everybody else because if you don't think we're not going to continue this discussion, you're wrong. So we've been at this a long time. And then the second point is, I would like, you know, when the realtors or organizations, home builders, get information, because I think one of the biggest questions everybody's asked this diocese over the last year on the homestead side is, what is that right level? What incentivize people to purchase homes, maintain homes, retain homes? And that's probably a $1 million question, not to be confused with the costs of the other two bills that were referenced.
Okay, sir, thank you.
Thank you for not referencing a real estate transfer tax center.
You know, I want to.
I know, I could see it in your eyes.
Let me get some back to some local governments. I'm going to get four people up here: Don Hudson, Mayor George Endicott, Mayor John McArdle, and Eric Chambers from Gresham. Okay. And because we have some more people after you, if you could keep your comments brief, if you're submitting written testimony, we'll have that. No need to read it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, my name is Don Hudson. I'm the finance director with the City of Tualatin, the chair of the League's Finance and Taxation Committee, and president-elect of the Oregon Government Finance Officers Association. I'd just like to spend a couple quick minutes expanding on a few points that the previous panel presented before me. One is that the permit rates were set using a relatively arbitrary formula back in 97, which ultimately penalized some entities that were fairly conservative at the time but weren't levying as much, as well as the fact that it levied using the 97 levy rate, so depending on what we were levying at that time, was actually a reduced amount and then divided by the previous year's RMV at a reduced amount as well. Since there was no ways, there were some entities that had to make some tough decisions to make going forward with that, and continue to have to make as AV grows at a slower pace than our expenses. For example, in Tualatin, we had a couple years back, our AV only grew less than 1%. Our expenses obviously were growing at a higher than that. Additionally, there's no ways for an entity to change that permanent rate. Cities are stuck dealing with the permanent rate from that time, and the only way to deal with that is through some temporary local option levies, which creates its own issues, and I'll talk about those in just a minute. A second factor is that people don't realize that Measure 5 limits can be exceeded if that gap between real market value and assessed value is large enough. As that shrinks, that's where we go further into compression. I could spend 3 hours talking about compression, so I won't today. As I mentioned, the outcome of this is that cities have to deal with their low permanent rates that aren't sufficient to cover operating costs. Councilor Nanke talked about that in a lot of cases it doesn't even cover public safety. Two options that have been used are local option levies and creating new special districts. Anytime those things happen, it adds to the limits that are out there, which then pushes us closer and closer to compression or over those Measure 5 limits. Because entities have had to factor in compression losses when they are setting local option levy rates or creating a new district, a lot of times we have to inflate the rates that we are asking for to compensate for those losses. I'm going to go over two quick examples of those for you today. The first is the City of Sweet Home. They have a low permanent rate that was set at $1.42. They've been funding police and library services through levies since 1986. At the same time, other taxing entities in their area have also passed local option levies. The voters in Sweet Home continue to approve these levies in 2010 at 60% and 55%. In 2015-16, they lost $918,500 to compression, which was 30% of their levies. Their levy rate is 82 cents. Currently, it's 82 cents for library and $6.40 for the public safety. They did go to the voters just this last November, those were passed. At another 60% for police and 58% for libraries. So you see their voters are very supportive of these two important services. They did have to raise their rates. So the library is now at $1.17. Police is at $7.85. The reason they had to do this is, as this chart shows, they were losing compression dollars to competing levies. So in order to keep more of the dollars local to the city of Sweet Home, they raised their rates. The impact was the Linn County Sheriff's levy was reduced in revenue in order to bring monies back. As these phenomena happen, they are competing against each other. And because they're at different times, they are having to be looked at differently. And I would say that when Linn County has to go back for the public safety levy, there's a good chance that they're going to increase their levy, which would then reduce the money staying in Sweet Home. City of Albany is under a similar scenario. Again, the Linn County voters passed their levy in 2010, renewed it in 2014. Those two levies lost $5.8 million in 15-16 to compression. The city of Albany went back out in 2012, renewed their levy to make it effective in 2014. It was 95 cents per thousand. They raised it to $1.15 in order to compensate for their compression losses to get down to that net of 95 cents. That didn't happen. They're still losing over $1 million on their public safety levy. These are just a few examples of how the system currently, if we do not look at adjusting the Measure 5 limits as we go to real market value and a homestead exemption, if we don't adjust the Measure 5 limits, we're going to continue to have some of these issues, which has issues for our cities as well as our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. I apologize in advance. I have a bad cold, as you probably noticed, and if I lose my voice, I'll pass on the mic here. I'm going to give an example in Redmond. I am the mayor of Redmond, Georgia, and past president of the League of Oregon Cities. You've already heard a lot of information about why this issue needs to be addressed, so I won't reiterate that. But I'll give you a couple of examples. Redmond's permanent levy rate is 616 per thousand. Bend, for example, right next door is 280. Bend has some pretty severe infrastructure problems that we don't as a result. We currently have our levy at 441. We voluntarily reduced it. And one of the issues we're very concerned in this bill is that you're talking about reestablishing your operating levy at where it is. We're one of those 10 cities that you heard Mayor Doyle address. If you look at our total levy, and you've heard the cap of $10 a thousand, if we went to our upper limit, we'd be at $11.59, which means somewhere along the way on those operating levies, someone's going to lose $1.59 a thousand, whether it's the library, the sheriff, the 911, and so forth. Currently, we're at $9.84 because we had voluntarily reduced our levy, so we're very close to the cap in any case, and we have had, since compression is property by property, we do have several houses that have ended up in compression and don't have to pay. A bit of a tongue-in-cheek here is that, you know, we got to vote on a temporary operating levy for 911, which would put us over the cap. And so my tongue-in-cheek, you know, we fought a Revolutionary War about taxation without representation. Well, in Redmond, we have representation without taxation. So we actually get to vote on measures that we will not have to pay for, again, as a result of Measure 5. The last point I'd like to make here is on local options. And, you know, The cities were obviously jealously want to protect our abilities to have local rule, and so would like you to keep that in mind. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. I'm John McCardle. I'm the mayor of Independence. I'm the past president of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm also past president of the Oregon Mayors Association. You know, we in cities, we're all about finding solutions on a day-to-day problem. When mayors get together, councilors get together, we talk about exciting things like water, sewer, roads, police and fire. Those are all infrastructure kinds of things, and the financial infrastructure is vitally important to us, and we're used to solving our own problems for the greater as often as possible. We can't solve the financial infrastructure problem that we have to deal with. Only you folks can do that because of that you can refer legislation to make all the changes that needs to happen to Measure 5 being a quarter century old. Only you folks can put all of that together in one coherent piece, because if we put it out, if it goes out piece by piece, there's winners and losers. It's a disaster. It further wrecks something that's not working very well. The league is really committed to the idea that we need to protect our citizens. We share the same citizens from volatility of ups and downs, and we need to have the problems and inequities taken care of. In my community in Independence, 13 and a half miles, it's close. Come for a drink.
They have good restaurants, too, by the way. Spend your money there.
There you go. Good man. Our permanent rate's $4.58. The county's $2.26. Special district's a little over $2. Okay, we're not quite in compression, but we're close. So if all of a sudden our Polk County Sheriff wants to do a public safety levy, an operating levy, or our fire district needs a public safety levy, okay, we're limited. All of a sudden, if the citizens want to vote for something and expect to get something, but even if they do, because of compression, it can wreck things, that we don't get what the voters want. I also want to talk about, mention that we're talking about cities, but you know, compression affects school districts and community colleges also. Your staff have already pointed out there. In addition to reviewing and revising measures 5 and 50, we need to take a look at the statutory property tax exemptions in the ORS Chapter 307. There are 132 different property tax exemptions. That's a boatload. That's hard to keep track of. Many of the exemptions are outdated, some are overly complex, and they don't provide local government with the right flexibility. Some things are going to happen on their own. We need you to make sure that local government has a chance to weigh in. We want to get away from automatic tax exemptions. It's just really hard. I know Senator Boquist is working a new business-friendly incentive on industrial properties this session, and it's a local option property tax exemption that can be tailored and work for our communities. I also want to bring up another issue that I think is really important. You know, we're all on different nonprofit boards and commissions. I'm on several. Each of you, I know from looking, are involved also. Some of those property tax exemptions are well outdated. Our communities need nonprofits and charities, there's no question. Our community, for instance, works with lots of folks. However, the exemptions are outdated, and the assessors are having a long and difficult time of struggling trying to figure out how to apply all these. I know there's a work group that's working on improving the charitable exemptions and sessions, and I think that that's an important consideration as you move forward in the 2017 sessions. Because with some communities having almost half of their property off the tax rolls, it's really difficult because those properties need police, fire, services, just like everything else. We need to figure out a way to make it work. That nonprofit tax exemption alone is $194 million on $24 billion in property that exempted. I need you folks to take a look at the financial infrastructure that we work with. I really want to encourage you, as was mentioned earlier, you folks have been working on this for a while. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. Trying to explain, real market value, assessed value, compression, it's difficult enough in this room than trying to go do it at the door. But we really need you folks to keep going. It's vitally important to the infrastructure and the citizens that we serve. Thank you very much for taking the opportunity to hear my comments.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Eric Chambers. I'm the Government Relations Director for the City of Gresham. We're deeply appreciative of your conversation around property taxes. We feel like we're uniquely harmed in Oregon's property tax system with both a full-service city without any special districts providing municipal services and an incredibly low permanent rate. For context, compression under Measure 5 would be a good problem for us to have in the property tax system that we face. So, and we know in terms of the broader revenue discussion, discussions that are happening in this building and across the state, it would be easy to ignore property taxes, and we really appreciate your interest in making sure that those are part of that. Just for a quick context, people have been talking about the percentage of property taxes that cover public safety. In Gresham, we get about $24 million a year in property taxes. Our police department alone costs about $26 million to operate. So our property tax, it's not even that they're not covering the cost of public safety, it's that they're not even getting through the police department. We are pretty concerned under the context of SJR 201 that it isn't necessarily speaking yet to the idea of permanent rate. The limits locked in 18 years ago reflected communities that were dramatically different. In Gresham, we've had about a 23% population increase over that period of time. Our fire calls for service over the same period of time have doubled annually, and our police calls for service have gone up 50%. So our community has changed rapidly over that period of time. We're 18% more diverse than we were in 1997. We've had a CPI-adjusted 10% decrease in median family income in Gresham. So the needs of the community right now are incredibly different than they were when Measure 50 passed. And having that permanent rate locked into that period of time, doesn't give us the opportunity to speak to the needs that we have right now at this point in time. This is a similar issue. I think it's important to note this is a similar issue that the timber counties in Oregon have. They have permanent rates that were locked in when they had, you know, significant receipts from federal timber sales or for subsequent payments from the federal government in lieu of timber sales. And they obviously don't have those revenue sources now, so they have incredibly low permanent rates that were also locked into a different set of circumstances at that point than we see now. So our strong hope would be that the committee would look at permanent rates as part of the overall reform package and have the opportunity for that to be part of the referral that ultimately goes to the voters. Oregon is blessed with visiting delegations from across the nation, across the world even, to come and see our unique approaches to public policy. I'm not aware of any of them that have come to hear about our property tax system. So, it's nearly nonsensical, and really appreciate the opportunity to get it connected to something in the real world like real market value. Senator, we appreciate that and certainly are supportive of the rolling average also that the bill would implement. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and I would just kind of reinforce the idea of everybody's got to be flexible here. You have a unique situation in your area. It's different in Deschutes County, you know, and probably there's not going to be anything that we could refer that's going to get unanimous or everybody's going to love 100% of it. So we always have to know that going in to any kind of these propositions. So questions of this panel, Senator Boquist?
Yeah, a couple of points just to make sure we have them on the record. And I wrote them down just because Mayor McArdle, who's in my neighboring district, said them. But, gentlemen, one of the things that I would point out, and I'm going to say a statement of action, not used it before, but and Chair Haas just pointed out, I mean, no consolidated, it has to be a consolidated plan. I mean, I'm under no illusion it's happening in the next 30 days, okay? I just, statement of fact. It has to be a consolidated plan. That means that some measure of low control will have to be given up to make the thing work across the board. Like I said, we started out with two lobbyists in the back corner there. I don't know. I think we've done like 8 or 9 hearings on this particular topic now in the last 12 months. Tales of woe, I get. I'm not sure it's helpful to the. It's not to me as one of the five old men sitting up here. It's not really helpful because we know the woes. What I really think that's going to be helpful to go forward in order to right size and simplify this, and we passed several bills that our colleagues in the House did not like, and Senator Riley and I have been tasked as individuals of the members of this committee to help go forward on those things that they didn't like because they agreed with them, they just didn't want to do the bills, such as the nonprofits and trying to streamline some of the stuff. But what is the most helpful, because if an agreement has come, homesteads, the real question is almost like the Swiss Alp question, and this is to cities, counties, special districts, we're going to have to know really what your present value is of current services. And when I say that, what I'm talking about is, because you may talk, well, we pass a bond here, we pass a deal here, is going out and saying we need more money isn't worth my vote to refer it anywhere because it'll just fail. I'm just telling you, it'll fail at the point. But going out and saying this is the right size, this is the fair way to do it, this is to help the homeowner, this is to stabilize the city, this is to stabilize the water district, is that's the sort of message we're going to be able to carry. And as you pointed out, there are ways around this. There are some people without compression, and some people that are doing this. There's some people that are under, some people that are over. I mean, the slide, one's at 88% and one's at 166%. And so to right-size it, you know, what is that value of present services that we're trying to fill today, right? Not just I want more money, because that does not sell to the voter at this particular time, especially when you see the revenue forecast in a week. That's the message I would say to the cities, counties across the board. Not particularly to you individuals, but you guys get the deal here. When you go to the voter, you're going to say, what am I doing now? And this would be a whole lot easier. You're going to get the same level of services, and we'll have some abilities to address these other issues. But, you know, if you took the bond, the levy, this and all this and put it together, this is what we're really doing. It's just totally screwed up. And you can't figure it out, and we can't figure it out. So that's my message to the cities, the counties, and so on and so forth. We get it. We've been at this for a while, most of us, and we get the woes, and I'll assure you that even though Mayor McArdle is not my district, every time I get close, my ear is burning. So I get it. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Matt Evans.
Anything important? You don't know either.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I am here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. It's a pleasure to be here representing the people that pay the taxes. We've heard from lots of people that collect the taxes and spend those taxes, but I think there's a few cautionary notes I want to sound about this proposal and about overhauling the property tax system in general. First of all, it's important, I think, to understand that property taxes are inherently regressive. They are not tied in any way to a person's ability to pay. And this is why we got in trouble in the first place and why the voters eventually accepted Measure 5 as a limitation on property taxes. There's no relationship between what somebody earns in their life and what they can afford to pay in property taxes. This is why we have property tax deferral programs for senior citizens and for the disabled in this state. We have in the past, and we are obviously continuing to do, because we have thousands of people taking advantage of these programs, pricing people out of their homes with property tax increases. I don't think anybody would argue there's no inequities in the property tax system. I think it's true. There are some. The concern that I think we have going forward is the kind of changes that we're talking about here would eliminate some of those inequities, but it would create new ones and lock them permanently into the Constitution. For example, there was a great chart that I think Mayor Doyle put up that showed that there are people who are essentially maximum assessed value at their real market value, and a lot of other people that aren't. Well, under a homestead exemption, the folks that are currently at RMV for purposes of assessment get a property tax cut, but people that aren't don't, unless the homestead exemption is big enough to close that gap up. In my personal case, and the people that live in my neighborhood, it wouldn't. We would get a property tax increase. Another concern I would bring forward is the fact that I appreciated the chair said we're all in this together. I know he's great at listening and trying to bring everybody to the table and listening to what they have to say. But the fact of the matter is that the measure as proposed is a property tax increase on businesses. They're not in this. We're not in it together with them. Homeowners get a property tax reduction in some instances. Businesses all get a property tax increase. And there was a chart that was put up, I think, during the LRO presentation that showed exactly that. I think we have to be additionally careful because, of course, voters approved the property tax system that we have right now. Measure 5 and Measure 50 are the ones that are in place. Measure 50, of course, was written by this legislative body. What we have is a result of, despite the fact that voters approved it, this body wrote it in response to the passage of Measure 47 that was written by he who will not be named.
We actually like him.
And And so I think we need to be really cautious and humble going forward about our ability to craft a one-size-fits-all property tax system and have it come out right. I think we're in danger of simply changing who's disadvantaged permanently. Just the last thing I'll say, and then I'd be happy to take questions if there are any. Any changes, we believe, have to be revenue neutral. I also want to agree with the previous testimony about if there's going to be a homestead exemption, it has to be two things, locked in the Constitution, and secondly, a homestead exemption doesn't do me any good if my property taxes are based on real market value that's increasing rapidly when the homestead exemption doesn't increase. So the homestead exemption has got to be tied to real estate value changes, up or down, or it's really not that valuable to me, and I'm looking for at a property tax increase as my property becomes more valuable, regardless of my ability to pay. Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Hope you remain flexible. And we're cutting taxes. We're taking some swipes out there. Questions? Thank you, Matt.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We are running out of time here, so I'll call up Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly.
Chair Hassan, members of the committee, I'll try to not repeat things that have been already said and said, talk about the things that I haven't heard said much. The bill does, I think, a sensible job of addressing the real market value, assessed values, ups and downs. It might be good to see that, see examples of that, to see how well it works, but the fact that you're not looking at it goes up every, 11% this year, and then goes up 0% next year or something like that. That's to the kind of phase in of several years. The use of several years is a very good idea. And I wanted to make another point of that. I happen to have one of those properties that has a really low assessed value. If this went into effect, probably a homestead exemption of $200,000 would still mean I would have a tax increase of $4,000 a year. Otherwise, without any, my taxes would go up 2.5 times. So it would be nice, and if IP 28 passes, we might have the luxury of having a 5-year phase-in for people who face big increases. I could handle it, but many property owners couldn't. No one has spoken to equalizing participation in school funding. When we looked around the state, we found homes of same value paying between $1,000 and $4,000 in property taxes, since education dollars are about 44%, I believe, of the taxes that for most homes. That means the $1,000 home, the home with that tax base is paying about $440 in school taxes, and the home with $4,000 in taxes is paying 4 times that much in school taxes. And that's simply not fair given the current school funding formula. It made sense back before these measures passed, when most school funding came from the local community. But now that it comes to most from the state, it makes sense that every dollar, there should be a rate for K-12 funding and ESDs that is the same across the state in order to just be basically fair. The fact that there are so many property tax exemptions and they have not been well evaluated is extremely important. They need review and reconsideration because, of course, especially the service districts or the full service cities are providing services to those properties, and they're not getting any revenue for it. This city is a perfect example right here. I mean, why should we exempt all state property from property taxes? Probably not. And the other point that I think Mayor Doyle's slide made and Senator Hass, you reiterated, is the public simply is not aware of the problem. And we can't take something to them until they're really aware of the problem. We need the, you know, the banner people that are the examples of how this is going to be good for them, or and how it's unfair between two sisters that live in the same town or something, so that people really get a picture of how bad things are, because unless they're buying a house, they're really not aware of the inequities. And if they're buying a house and already know the neighborhood they want, they're probably not aware of the inequities. And so that the problem needs to become really conscious in the public's mind before we could go forward with the changes that we absolutely need. And I credit you greatly, Senator Haas, for keeping bringing this to our attention, because it's essential. It's the worst part of our tax system by far.
Marsha Kelly, Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. The Oregon Women's Rights Coalition believes in equitable and fair taxation, and so we really are encouraged that you were having a discussion about this, and it needs to be a complete discussion. The issue of compression does affect the services that entities are able to provide to my constituents. Women normally are about 79 cents per dollar for men, so they oftentimes try to figure out ways that they can save money in getting to their employment. Public transportation is one of the services that gets impacted if you're in a district where property tax is the level. And the property tax exclusions that can affect other districts are really, really important to look at as well. If an entity that is a city says, we want to give this entity property tax abatement, they're giving it for everybody, not just the city. And so it impacts the other special districts that may be layered upon them ability to provide the services that they are supposed to. The transit district in Salem went out for a payroll tax in November, because if we would have gone for a property tax in order to try to get the $5 million to provide weekend and Sunday service, the ask would have had to have been 55 cents to be able to get maybe 36 cents. And because of compression, people in Kaiser, East Salem, and West Salem would be paying, and virtually none of the residential property in Salem would have been paying because of the way the compression happens. I've read some of the testimony, and one of the written testimony suggested doing the, when you're doing your valuing, when you set your value up, that you use the city value instead of the county value. It's really remarkably different what the average value would be versus a city versus a county if you're going to that. It's really, really hard to do, but it shouldn't be done lightly, and you need to make sure that when everyone is involved in the conversation, all of the people who need to know, so that we can bring something that voters can understand when you're trying to talk about why you might need more money. And maybe if you reformed it, we wouldn't need as much money.
Questions? Thanks to you both. We're out of time. There's a couple of people still signed up. We're going to take another swing at this. We'll get to everyone, hopefully, in coming days and weeks. Thank you for this discussion. I think there were some good insights and points to consider. And we'll keep at it. So thank you. Any other business here before us? Paul, the next meeting is Tuesday, so we've got some homework. And I'll be talking to you individually about some bills in the pipeline. So with that, we are adjourned. With that, we are adjourned.